and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
It's somewhere the classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, this is Michael Lauck. I am not Martin Willis, as you've already figured out. Martin has taken a couple of weeks off and asked me to come in and pinch hit, and I readily agreed to come back to Podcast UFO, partially because he has guaranteed me some great guests. And the very first one we'll get to in a second, but first I have some housekeeping, as it were. As we are live at 9 o'clock Eastern on Wednesday night, the Podcast UFO website is down. So I won't be able to get to people in chat tonight because I can't get connected to the site. I don't know if it's working in some places and not others. It looks like, however, what's happened is the site is just too busy. I don't know what Martin's going to do about that, but if you've ever thought about donating to the show, this might be the time, because it looks like he might need to be paying some more hosting bills here in the future. So I apologize for that. It shouldn't affect the podcast. It definitely doesn't affect us on the Dark Matter Radio Network, which is great because I was looking forward to tonight. I hope you were as well, because our guest, who we will introduce right now, is really known to everyone, and that is Mr. Stanton Friedman. Are you there, Stan?
I'm here. Oh, that was your introduction.
Okay. That's my introduction, all in one breath.
Yeah, I'm here in the flesh in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, in the Atlantic time zone, which is a little different from yours.
Yes, because I am in the Central time zone, and people listening are all over the world. So we're having a little international broadcast tonight, which is
good.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun. Now, it's hardly your first, and in fact, you're going to be on another radio show on Dark Matter right after this one. So, because I think everybody knows who you are. If you're interested in UFOs for more than 5 minutes, you run across the work of Stanton Friedman. What I'd like to do tonight, if we can, because A, because you're going to be on the network for a good little bit, and B, because you've been on this show, I know, several times, is maybe ask you some questions that you don't field very often. Starting with just what is your background, not as far as getting into UFOs, but what is the professional background of Stanton Friedman as a nuclear physicist, which is something that we all attach to your name.
Okay. Well, I spent 2 years at Rutgers University in New Jersey and then 3 years at the University of Chicago, and I got my bachelor's and master's in physics there, and then I went out in the real world. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years at Chicago, incidentally. And then I had an interesting sequence of 14 years of working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs. They were fascinating, and it was a surprise. My father worked for the same company for 37 years. I figured I'd work for my first company was General Electric. They had several nuclear divisions. What the heck? I could retire when I was 57, I think, a combination of age and years at the company. Well, boy, the world had changed. The first 3 years were working for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, believe it or not, in Evendale, Ohio, just outside Cincinnati. And we were looking at, can you build a nuclear power aircraft? We thought you could. It wasn't a small program. And one of the things that surprises the academics of the world is that there's a heck of a lot of research and development that's gone on outside of academic, and usually with much bigger budgets than you find in academia. In 1958, we spent $100 million We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. It was fun. I was working particularly on radiation shielding, which is a major problem for when you're going to use nuclear-powered aircraft or rocket or whatever. You do want to have your pilots survive the effort, after all. And we did operate jet engines on nuclear power. We didn't fly a plane on nuclear power. There was a huge B-36, monster airplane, sometimes with six or eight engines, which did carry a small nuclear reactor to create radiation so you could find out the effect of the air around it on the radiation levels nearby, because they scatter, because they produce the neutrons that come out produce gamma rays, and they get to the pilot too. But it had nothing to do. I've seen people act as though it had something to do with flying the airplane, and it didn't. And I should point out that for airplanes, we were talking about power levels of the reactor of 300-400 megawatts. A submarine takes one-tenth that power. We do have nuclear-powered submarines, but it's a different animal, in other words. They use water-cooled reactors. They don't operate at real high temperature. The aircraft nuclear propulsion system, the air would come in, get heated in the reactor, and leave it about 1,800 degrees for the turbines. That's hot, very hot. So you had temperature problems, you had radiation problems, you had weight problems. Fascinating program, and I got a chance to do a lot of interesting experiments before I got out because I saw the handwriting on the wall. And my next stint was to work at Aerojet General Nuclionics in California, in the Bay Area. And initially, I worked on a program where we were designing a compact nuclear reactor for space applications. You go nuclear when you want a lot of energy in a small place, and when you recognize, of course, that solar energy is not terribly efficient. The further you get from the sun, the lower the level. So nuclear power seems to offer a real advantage. And the Russians, incidentally, built about 33 compact nuclear reactors. The United States only launched one, which is a little known fact, which tells you something, I guess. Anyway, we worked on that for a while, and they canceled that program in order to give it to the other company working on nuclear airplanes, Pratt Whitney. Pratt Whitney and GE were the two big aircraft engine manufacturers. And they had liquid metal-cooled reactor experience, which is a great way to transfer a lot of heat in small volume. And so our program got canceled. And then the whole aircraft nuclear propulsion program got canceled, and we worked on something that was really exciting, fusion propulsion for deep space travel. Nuclear fusion is a major source of energy throughout the universe. All the stars, including ours, produce their energy by nuclear fusion. It's not a massive burning gas, as we thought it was. We didn't know about fusion until 1938. That's important because we're Johnny-come-latelys in the neighborhood, surely. That's the same year we found out about fission, too, which I will get into in a minute. But nuclear fusion is really exciting because the amount of energy per pound, if you will, of fuel is extraordinary. And you can see that we Earthlings are very good at making better weapons. So we have a little progression. From 1944, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. It released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Wow! Make a big hole in the ground. A lot of them, it took a B-29 to carry it. A big, in quotes, B-29. That was in 1944. In 1945, we had our first fission bomb, nuclear fission. That's using uranium or plutonium. And the energy release equivalent to 17,000 tons of TNT. So you go from 10 to 17,000. And 7 years later, that was in 45, in 1952, we tested our first H-bomb, hydrogen bomb, fusion device, if you will. And it released the energy, believe it or not, of 10 million tons of TNT. And the Russians tested one a few years later. That was 50 million tons of TNT energy release. So you get this enormous change. Now, fusion can be used for propulsion. You can exhaust particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in the dumb old chemical rocket. And so that puts us in the company of the advanced civilizations in our neighborhood. Everybody knows that fusion is the thing. And as soon as we demonstrated that, then clearly it could be used for propulsion and to get us to the stars. And if we wanted to spend the money, that's the missing ingredient. It takes an enormous amount of money and development and so forth. And as far as I know, there is no national policy to develop fusion for, well, they talk about using it for power, but for, not for propulsion. There were studies done, little experiments done, but we got a long way to go before we have it on a, I'll call it a commercial basis. Now, I mention that because when I get people telling me, well, why don't the aliens just come down and land and say hi? In other words, why don't they land on the White House lawn? And there are a couple of obvious reasons. One of them is that we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. In World War II, we only killed 50 million of our own kind, Earthlings. We destroyed 1,700 cities. This year, we'll only spend $1 trillion on things military. So we're not nice guys, and we have exploded. A lot of people forget that besides the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that first one in New Mexico at Trinity Site, we Earthlings have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons, some of them fusion devices. And incidentally, fusion, the fuel, if you will, the propellant, isotopes of hydrogen, which just happens to be the lightest and most abundant element in the universe. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen. Uranium is one of the heaviest elements and a bit hard to come by comparison. So that's very convenient. You know, set up a refueling station someplace, you can find the hydrogen. And the kicker here is that not only have we exploded weapons, and there are new countries that will be developing them, I presume, but anybody who comes here would recognize that we're a threat to the neighborhood. I presume that every society has a requirement for national security, planetary security, if you will. And they would have to worry about the primitives in the neighborhood or show signs of being able to bother them. And we did. And when I talk about us being a young society, we didn't even know that there were neutrons until 1932. Fission and fusion, 1938, not really demonstrated, but we became aware of it. And so considering that the planet's over 4 billion years old and the galaxy maybe 13 billion years old, obviously it doesn't look like we're one of the more advanced civilizations. And look, if we'd been talking, oh, say 40 years ago, there'd have been people saying, what are you talking about extraterrestrial life? This is the only group of planets in the universe. We don't see any other planets. So we're it. We're top of the heap. We Earthlings are the big shots in the neighborhood. Sorry, but according to Kepler, there in our galaxy are literally billions of planets. And some of them undoubtedly a lot older than ours. And interestingly enough, nobody wants to talk about the distribution of stars. The nearest star to the sun is about 4.3 light years away, not exactly down the street. But there are pairs of stars in our neighborhood which are less than an eighth of a light year apart. And one would expect there's more incentive for travel when you got a next-door neighbor than when it's pretty far away. That seems reasonable to me. you have more of an incentive. And I bring this up because of the Betty and Barney Hill case, where there was a star map observed by Betty, and where under hypnosis from Dr. Benjamin Simon, an outstanding world-class authority on PTSD, shell shock war veterans, they were called back then, but the same difference. The star map that she saw, thanks to the brilliant work of a woman named Marjorie Fish, the base stars seemed to be two stars nobody's ever heard of, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, in the constellation of Reticulum, the net, that means. And you can't see them from here. You got to go below the equator. I sure wish you could see them from north of the equator so that after my lecture I could say, let's go out and look at Zeta Reticuli. I can't do that. Anyway, those two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart. They're only 39.3 light years from here. And that's an entirely different situation. From a planet around one, looking at the other, you can see it all day long. So we need to take into account the variations in distribution. And, you know, everything changes, varies. The stars are different size, planets are different size, different age, different temperatures. And something else that I found, I was surprised, frankly, when I mentioned uranium, it's one of the heaviest elements. And more than 1.5 times the density of lead, as a matter of fact. You know, heavy as lead, light as balsa wood, but lead isn't the heaviest element. Osmium's twice as heavy, as dense as lead. But uranium is one of the heavier elements. And what's interesting is that the Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. Cubic meter, if you will, of Earth weighs more than a cubic meter of any of the other planets. And you say, so what? Well, that means there are more of these heavy metals, which are rare in the universe. We know that from studying what's in the stars. Some astronomers said in the 19th century that we'd never know the composition of the stars. That's before we developed the spectrum analysis, et cetera, et cetera. So things like osmium, rhenium, platinum, these are really dense and have special properties. And so somebody might be mining them here for all we know. So we need to take into account of reality. Anyway, after they canceled the program at Aerojet General Nucleonics, I went on to General Motors Allison Division in Indianapolis. We were working on a compact reactor for ground applications, really, the military compact reactor program, MCR. And that got canceled after 3 years. Your lab in Pittsburgh. And there, at least we built something and it worked. Nuclear rocket engines, the NERVA program, Nuclear Energy for Rocket Vehicle Applications, NERVA. There were three groups involved in the overall program. One was Westinghouse Astronuclear, where I was. One was Aerojet General in Sacramento, California. And the third was Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. And we each successfully tested one in the 60s out at the nuclear test site just outside Vegas. One I worked on was less than 7 feet in diameter. Power level was 1,100 megawatts. That's half the power of Grand Coulee Dam, which is just a mite larger. And cold hydrogen comes in, gets heated in the reactor to over 4,000 degrees and gets kicked out through the nozzle. And by Newton's laws, what is kicked out that way pushes back the other way, and you got a nuclear rocket engine. You could almost triple the payload to Mars if you use nuclear as opposed to chemical. And as a matter of fact, most of us working on the program thought that surely we would have a base on Mars, on the moon first, and that we'd go to Mars using a nuclear upper stage. Well, it didn't happen, and we don't have a base on the moon either, as far as I know. Now, Los Alamos' reactor, incidentally, closer to 8 feet in diameter, power level 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam. And it worked, did what it was supposed to do. And then, of course, the program was canceled. The Aerojets was only 1,000 megawatts, type system. And it worked, and the program was canceled. So that's my history. Now, I thought when I got laid off at Westinghouse, I looked for a job, of course, and I thought I had found what would be the ideal job for me. Talked to people at McDonnell Douglas Astronautics in California, and they could use a little of the money being set for the manned orbiting laboratory program, sort of Air Force competition for NASA. Big program. They could use a little for blue sky stuff, you know, where you don't know whether you're going to be successful or not, but if you are, it's a huge advance. And my job, after being interviewed out there and there are people hearing me lecture and stuff, was to figure out how flying saucers worked. And I was really looking forward to it. I had my ideas. And then as I was driving across the country from Pittsburgh to California, I heard on the radio the MOLE program had just been canceled, which would have paid for my way. When I got there, I walked in with my offer letter, and the gal says, you realize we've just laid off 5,000 people. Yeah, I realize that. So they kept me for 3 months. And one of the things I did accomplish, which was useful, interesting, I had a literature search done on government technical report literature, not all scientific literature. And the one word we used, a key word, magneto-aerodynamics. And much to my surprise, my search turned up 900 references, of which 90% were classified. And what that relates to is that if you ionize the air, making an electrically conducting fluid, it glows like a meteor ionizes the air, and that's what you see. And when the Apollo command module comes back to the Earth, remember how you can't communicate there for a while because ionized air plasma is around it and electromagnetic waves don't penetrate through it? Anyway, it turns out you can get around all the problems of high-speed flight. You can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, all these good things. If you have air around the craft and you ionize it with lasers or all kinds of electrical techniques. But that was a lot of work already going on in 1970, believe it or not. So when I think what we need to recognize, of course, is that we've got a two-part problem here. How do you get to the Earth from another solar system? A lot of nothing between us and the next solar system. And once you're here, how do you operate in the atmosphere? Two entirely different environments, pressure, temperature, all that stuff in the atmosphere, and in the space, nothing. And we already, as a nuclear guy, I am proud to say, we already have systems that use this sort of two-stage approach. We have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, which, believe it or not, can operate for 18 years without refueling.
Oh, I
can't do that with gasoline.
Right. Yeah. I actually set out as a young man when I started college in 1990 to go into nuclear physics, and that was a bad time to go into the industry. So I ended up switching my majors after some investigation. But one of my big options was ending up, you know, working with the Navy at that point. There, nuclear energy has gotten some bad press in the last few years with,
of course,
things like the you know, little incident
Fukushima
in Japan. Yeah. Do you stand by nuclear energy as a reliable source of power for our civilization now?
Well, I'm not saying it's the ultimate, of course, but I would say yes. There are over 400 nuclear reactors around, and they actually have a pretty darn good track record. You got to compare them with the other systems. I mean, coal isn't very pleasant. We had a little oil disaster down there in the Gulf. Solar is nice, but it takes a lot of stuff to make the stuff that you use, and you despoil the land. It takes an awful lot of land to produce power comparable with a reactor. Now, you know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, somebody once said. And we recognize, I mean, with Fukushima, obviously, the big problem was the little storm that came along after the earthquake. I don't know if you saw the pictures of the houses being carried out by the water. It was incredible, and that caused the loss of the fuel. I'm not saying they didn't make any mistakes, but, you know, 30,000 people got killed on American highways last year, and nobody's saying, oh, get all the cars off the road. They're terribly dangerous. Well, they can be dangerous, and they can be safe, and we have seat belts and so forth, and, you know, looking for perfection isn't very useful. You know, I used to be a big baseball fan, and, you know, you're a darn good hitter if you get a hit a third of the time. You don't say he's a lousy player because two-thirds of the time he didn't get a hit. So there are failures, there are strikeouts, but there are home runs as well. And so I'd say nuclear is doing a darn good job. More than half the power in France is produced by nuclear reactors, and there are several under construction now in different parts of the world. So do you have to be careful? You're darn right. But that's what life's all about, isn't it?
Right. Now, looking back, as we've been discussing your career, do you ever sit, you know, at the end of the day, which I'm sure for you is quite late because you're constantly doing these interviews and such, and have a cup of tea and say, yeah, I think I answered one of the questions I was going to ask you, which was, you know, did you have a dream project that you didn't get to work on? Which I think we just kind of discussed that. But do you ever sit down and go, man, why didn't I take this job? Or why didn't I, you know, I wish I was teaching on some faculty somewhere. Are you thrilled with the way it's turned out?
I couldn't have predicted the way it has turned out. But I never intended to be a college-level teacher. I didn't get my piled higher and deeper degree. And a lot of young people don't realize that a lot of one's life back then was determined by the draft board. It was sitting waiting. I was born in 1934, lowest high school, smallest high school graduating class. That was the height of the Depression. And so Uncle Sam wanted you for the Korean War and then the Vietnam War, you know. So what jobs you took, I would like to have taken a year off. I worked my way through 5 years of college. I was a busboy in the Catskill Mountains, and I was a union waiter in Chicago. Good one, too. You had to be in the union in Chicago. They killed union organizers in the Catskills. And I would like to have taken a year off, but I couldn't. I took my draft board physical before I started work for GE, but because there was a government research and development project, I was deferred. And when I got older, I was eligible until I was 35 for the draft. The draft board says, oh, we got lots of 18-year-olds coming along now. We don't need you old guys. But it did have an impact, in other words. And no, actually, I worked on exciting programs. And I was just recently, last year, as a matter of fact, I gave a talk at the National Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas. And it just reminded me that the best moment in my professional life was when that NRX-A6 nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system operated successfully out at the nuclear test site. We didn't know whether it would be successful or not. Nobody had done anything like that before. And there was a little sideline that had me worried. about 2 weeks before the test was going to be run, one of the project guys came to me and said, Stan, we need to know better what the nuclear heating rates are in the control vanes. We don't want to waste our propellant. Can you make some measurements for us? And I said, yes, I think so. And we had a little test facility not far from where I worked in Pittsburgh. And I went down, talked to the people. We set up some experiments, and within 4 days we had the data that they needed, and we thought it was okay. But I'll tell you, when they started the test, I suddenly realized, hey, if I was wrong, they might melt the control vanes, and that would be very, very bad, and I would be blamed for it. So that was something that I had some concerns about. But, you know, how many young guys, and I was young when I started, get a chance to work on big projects. I was running experiments. We were spending using millions of dollars worth of materials, paying $40,000 a week to General Dynamics to operate the reactor, et cetera. And I was young, so I had a really good opportunity. Now, I would like to have taken a year off and sit and learn more physics. But I didn't have the opportunity, and I was glad to be able to support my family and get involved. I gave papers at meetings, some of them classified, about radiation shielding and stuff. And one of the interesting things was, in retrospect, I had very good preparation for my ufological activities, if you will, in this sense, that one of the things I find is a problem for the nasty, noisy negativists, the debunkers, if you will. There's some things they don't know anything about. One of them seems to be national security. I worked under security all those 14 years, wrote classified papers. I understood security. And I get people, the academics, saying governments can't keep secrets. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who just did the one that Carl Sagan did.
The new Cosmos.
Cosmos, yeah. He's an astronomer, sharp guy. But he said in a public lecture at Penn State University that the proof that the U.S. government can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia, which is a very funny line, but has nothing to do with reality. It's easy to prove the government can keep secrets. For example, the Washington Post in August of 2013 had an article about the black budget for military and intelligence this past year was going to be $52.6 billion. The three leading agencies were, of course, the CIA, the NSA, and the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. That's not pocket change, and it's all classified. If you want to get the NSA UFO documents, you can get a complete set, 156 pages. You can read one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out. It's top secret umbra. And the CIA has withheld many dozens of pages of top secret umbra UFO documents. That's by their statement. These are all blacked out except for a few words here and there. My favorite one is the one that says deny in toto on the front. That one's whited out, the whole page. They couldn't find 8 words to declassify. You know, so there's a real world out there, and the Dr. Tyson seems to know nothing about that. And Dr. Seth Shostak, one of the SETI people, you know, SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, by my definition book. Seth has said that the proof that the government can't keep secrets is what a lousy job FEMA did on Katrina, the hurricane, and how badly the post office is run. He didn't seem to be aware of the NSA, CIA, NRO, DIA, ONI. There's a whole alphabet soup of these agencies. The second thing is that my background prepared me for, if you will, is this question that we were just talking about, propulsion. These guys don't seem to be aware of where the action is. I've had a couple of people tell me, Stan, if Roswell really happened, they would have to have pulled half the physics props out of the colleges in the country. I just laughed. That's utterly absurd. Were they really unaware of Los Alamos and Sandia and Oak Ridge? And there's a whole Livermore, there's a whole bunch of these large, very competent laboratories where people have clearances as well as competence. Who cares about pulling up a college professor out? What does he know? And he doesn't have a clearance. He's in the publish or perish business. When you're in industry or the national labs, that's not what you're about. You're trying to get a job done. Find out what's really going on in the world. I admit I had, the example that I've used really is that the first nuclear chain reaction at the University of Chicago, Enrico Fermi's work, I had one guy say, there should have been an article immediately within a few months in the top physics journal. What are you, nuts? It was classified.
Yeah.
I have no problem when I'm tilting with the leaders of the anti-UFO movement, and people say, well, what do you mean movement, Stan? Come on, that's too strong a word. No, it isn't. The city people, after all, their jobs are in danger. If aliens are coming here, who needs them? I mean, I hate to say this on a radio program, but why would you use radio if you're coming here? Maybe sign language, or telepathy. You certainly don't need to depend on radio.
Well, we're not even really traditional radio. We're internet radio. Radio, so we understand.
Okay, well, technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. And it's about time the SETI people learned that they're not where the action is. They don't have the dough, for one thing. But they don't have any understanding of, how does a society work? If you want to know about the motivation of Earthlings, do you go to an astronomer? No, you might go to a psychiatrist, psychologist, maybe a lawyer, a social worker, et cetera. So what do they know about how societies act? It's not their bag, besides the technology not being their bag. And so putting together a large group to accomplish something rapidly of significance is important. But that's not what's going on at universities. Look, I've spoken at over 600 universities and colleges, so I get a pretty good chance. I've had a pretty good chance to see them in action. And there's quite a contrast between that and what goes on in the industry. And not only in terms of the money, but the people that are involved. Look, we wanted a stealth aircraft. Lockheed spent $10 billion in secret over a 10-year period developing a stealth aircraft. It's not 8 professors and 27 grad students. So there's a real world out there.
Right. Now, speaking of this kind of real world versus academia, normally, if you were a graduate of most colleges who has had a successful career and then written several successful books, you would be kind of a favorite alumni. You'd be mentioned. How are you treated by your alma mater?
That's an interesting question. In terms of the response of my lectures at colleges and professional groups around the world, I've spoken in 18 countries, 10 provinces, and all 50 states. I've only had 11 hecklers in all of those. And two of them were drunk. And so I presume that you get that many hecklers if you're talking about sports, politics, religion. Now, the University of Chicago, gal came here and spoke to me, did a pretty nice article about me. and then got deluged with some nasty, noisy, negativist letters, even from some people I knew from my college days. One guy was complaining, and I said, look, Peter, I'll send you my book. I won't read it. and that was typical. You know, it's like, I shouldn't say it, but Galileo trying to get the astronomers to look through his telescope. No way, Jose. Don't bother. Look, there are four basic rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation, because investigation is too much trouble, and no one will know the difference anyway. So I'm constantly, you know, I've done debates on Coast to Coast Radio, for example, and I was on with Michael Shermer, Dr. Michael Shermer, and I got 80% of the vote, and he got 20%. Why? Because he didn't know anything. He hadn't done his homework. Didn't think he needed to, I guess. Seth Shostak and I debated. I got 57%, he got 33%, and 10% said, I don't know who won. These guys are so accustomed to getting away with making stupid comments. There is no data is one of the things. Or why aren't they ever seen on radar? Or it's just anecdotal information.
The radar one drives me crazy. Because we know we have aircraft designed not to be seen on radar. You know, we're actively
looking. But they are seen on radar. I mean,
sometimes. True. I mean,
that's the kicker. If you look at the congressional hearings of 1968, Jim McDonald's paper, Dr. James E. McDonald, professor of physics at the University of Arizona, he has a number of radar sightings, radar visual sightings. It's like sightings by pilots. And loads of them. There's a group called NARCAP. Let's see, National Aviation Reporting Center for
Aerial
Anomalous Phenomena.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's well over a thousand sightings, and some of the people involved are people like Dr. Richard Haynes, who worked for NASA for 18 years. You know, there's plenty of good data. But these guys won't look at it. And I made lists on occasion of all the false claims that they've made. You know, I personally have the same problem with some of the people in the field who attack MJ-12 without doing their homework either. But, you know, the rules apply in all directions for noisy negative. Good guys or bad guys.
In the field of ufology, for lack of a better word, do you personally, I have to say, and I'm not, you know, a serious researcher or anything like that by any stretch of the imagination, but I am one of, I guess, probably best typified as the UFO fan community, of which there is a great deal. I've got a life, I've got a job, I've got other things going on. I'm not going to go out in the field and research UFOs. I might go hunt Bigfoot in any given that I could see, but I'm more of a woods kind of guy. I read the books. I follow certain television shows and things like that. And I fall in the definite kind of nuts and bolts category. It makes the most sense to me. And I see sometimes researchers starting out in their careers being of that bent. And as they go along, kind of switching to this very nebulous, ethereal, transdimensional being. I'm going to put that in air quotes for, you know, things like that. And then, of course, some people kind of start out in that. And I think some people come to UFOs looking for a new religion, setting them aside, going from the researchers who go from nuts to bolts. Do you think people lose their patience sometimes and turn to these transdimensional explanations because they haven't found the answers? And do you think it's a frustration thing?
Well, I think it's a frustration, but also they don't know where to look for the answers. I get people who seem to, in effect, say, well, what else could they be? You can't get here from there with a rocket. So it must be, you know, fifth dimensional space-time warping or wormholes or stuff like that. And then the others, there are some people who take the religious side of things. On the other hand, I wish those people would look at Dr. Barry Downing's book, Flying Saucers in the Bible. He looks at the Old and New Testament. He's got a degree in physics and then a doctor of divinity. That's kind of an unusual combination. Divine physics is Barry's beat. He makes sense out of stuff that's seen in the Bible, Old and New Testament. So, yeah, I guess people don't want to be bothered getting the facts in hand before putting their mouth in gear. And yet, that was a lesson I learned in grade school. I commented about something a teacher had said, that the whole solar system, you know, the planets go around the sun, and that's all there is. And I had just read in our 49-cent volume encyclopedia, which you bought at the supermarket, that the whole solar system was moving around the center of the galaxy at 12 miles a second. Boy, that sounded awful fast. So I piped up in class, and Miss Gutkin said, no, that's not the way it is, because she was reading from a book. And I don't argue with teachers, but the next day I brought in the encyclopedia and showed her, and, well, maybe that's the way it is, she said. But it taught me a lesson, facts in hand before mouth and gear. I was a high school debater. We won a state championship one year. And you don't make up stuff, but you do your homework. And you have to know both sides of the argument, because if you don't know which side you may be arguing at a debate tournament. And most people, they want to satisfy their own feelings. There's certain things they can't believe. Some can't believe that we're alone in the universe. Well, that's fine. That's a belief system. I tend to agree with that. You know, there's an awful lot of waste space, as somebody once said, if we're the only ones. And it's a sad commentary about the omnipotent God, if we're the best he or she can do, you know. Well, we've made kind of a... We haven't done a good job of it on this planet. You know, I remember the Depression. I remember the war. And I have a great-grandson, and I worry about what kind of world is he going to grow up in, because we don't seem to be getting any smarter about how we do things. How many kids died of starvation yesterday instead of... Couldn't they have been fed instead of spending that trillion on things military? You know. So I think there's a lot of people who make up solutions, you know, sort of what if, as if they were trying to look for plots for science fiction novels or something. And in my last paper, which was supposed to have been given at the MUFON conference in July, but I had a heart attack before that, so I couldn't go. I went over some of the dumb things that the science fiction writers have said as well. Isaac Asimov, Ben Bova, Arthur Clarke. I document what they said and how stupid it was. I mean, Isaac was a great writer, no question. More than 400 books, wow, and about loads of different subjects. But he comes up with a crazy calculation that the average distance between advanced civilization is 13,500 light years. In the first place, that's pretty stupid when you figure that there are 2,000 stars within 54 light years of here. That's an awful small percentage that have a civilization. But then he says, oh, with the nearest one being 13,500 light years. Now, a junior high school student knows just because the average is 13,000 doesn't mean the nearest one is 13,000. It could be 10, you know. And then he says, if aliens were coming here, they would either make themselves known or keep hidden. If they do neither, they're not coming here. Like, he suddenly became an expert on alien behavior, which one of his articles appeared in TV Guide, 18 million readers at the time. What a lot of propaganda from a respected writer. You know, so there are problems here with this kind of stuff. He's afraid, fear of ridicule. Now, I checked my audience, most of my audience at the end of my lectures. I don't have guts enough to do it at the beginning. And find that I ask how many people here believe they've seen what I would call a flying saucer. And I prefer the term flying saucer because all flying saucers are UFOs. Very few UFOs are flying saucers. All great-grandfathers are men. Very few men are great-grandfathers. You know, you've got to watch which direction you change. You turn your analogies, so
right.
to speak. And I just am appalled by some of the false reasoning. Even Arthur Clarke said years ago, oh, nobody's interested in these things anymore except for the cultists. And the Astronomer Royal of England, a little over a year ago, said only kooks see UFOs. Did he provide any evidence to support that statement? Not at all. So part of the problem is the press not saying, where did that statement come from? Carl Sagan, for example. I had challenged him to a debate, but then I found out he was suffering from cancer, so I backed off. I had visited him when I spoke at Cornell. He has said that there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable. There are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, but there are no interesting and reliable sightings, which sounds like a very profound thought based on loads of data. No reference, no source, and it's totally untrue, according to the largest study ever done for the United States Air Force. Just the reverse. The better the reliability of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. But nobody criticized Carl. Nobody criticized the Secretary of the Air Force when he flat out lied, saying only 3% of the cases couldn't be identified. And that's just because there wasn't enough data. That study, 3,200 cases, that's a lot of cases, 21.5% were unexplainable, completely separate from 9.3%. For which there wasn't enough information. So the press has been really had a failure of nerve. And it may sound funny, but you know that within 2 weeks of the start of World War II in the United States, Pearl Harbor Day, and started a couple of years earlier in Europe, of course, there was a director of censorship appointed. And I'm beginning to wonder if maybe that office was never closed.
you never know. Now, you just mentioned a lot of science fiction authors, and that's another question I had here on my list if we got to it. I was wondering if in his free time, when he is sitting in a hotel room, you know, after a lecture, particularly given this week is the 48th anniversary of Star Trek airing for the first time, do you enjoy science fiction?
I read a lot when I was 10 or 12 years old because I had a friend who had a basement full of the old pulp magazines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I used to take home two or three at a time and read from those. And then I got interested in real science. And I don't pay a lot of attention. I don't dislike science fiction per se as a genre. But I'm much more interested in the real world. It's so much more exciting.
Okay, well, I have a follow-up question.
I like murder mysteries.
You like murder. So do you like Asimov's mysteries? Because, you know, Asimov,
what?
He wrote mysteries, you know, Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question to that then. Have you seen, because you are probably, there's no probably about it. You have a much bigger depth of knowledge in the fields and in the trends than I ever will. Have you seen a huge direct impact of popular science fiction in UFO sightings? And I ask because you will hear the claim that people see, you know, these small aliens with big heads because they were at the end of Close Encounters, completely ignoring the fact that they were at the end of Close Encounters because they were based on, you know, reported sightings. But are there instances when Doctor Who was at, you know, this crazy popularity in the 60s, were people seeing Daleks on the street, for example,
I don't think that there was a big interest influence of science fiction on public perception about the world around us. And some of that's good. They opened up the idea that there might be others out there, that they might be coming here, that they might look different, act different, et cetera. But I think the reason you found small beings in Close Encounters is that's what the witnesses described. I think the input is the other way around, that the witnesses described certain things, and then the science fiction, you know, and then followed it, so to speak, not the other way around. I mean, there's different goals. Science fiction writer doesn't care, you know, what the truth is. He wants entertainment, and there's nothing wrong with entertainment. I'm not complaining about that. And if it gets people thinking, and I frankly, today, I think it's obvious there's an enormous interest in the part of television and so forth in stories and movies and stories related to aliens. Wouldn't you say some of the big grossing films are alienated, if you
will? The biggest grossest movie this summer, I think everybody's an alien in it. The Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, yeah, and so what I'm saying is not that people aren't interested and not that science fiction doesn't get a lot of people reading and so forth, although I read the first couple of books of the Harry Potter series and my daughter gave me some and I enjoyed them. It was fun. And anything that gets kids reading is good as far as I'm concerned. I've had people say, Stan, I don't read books anymore. You got any DVDs? Yeah, I got DVDs. But the information input rate is so much greater for a book than it is for a movie. You know, you talk at 100 words a minute and you read at 500 words a minute. Incidentally, I do have a website, www.stantonfriedman.com, which lists my books, five and several DVDs, and, you know, you can order with PayPal, and I autograph the books I send out, which isn't, I don't mind you buying them from Amazon, but you don't get an autograph from Amazon. Maybe that's next year, I don't know. Maybe I could sit here and autograph, and it would go on a book there. Wouldn't that be neat?
Oh, it's probably coming. Now, believe it or not, we're into the last minute of the show. So I'm glad that you threw out your website because I was just about to ask you to do that. You will, of course, be on, if people are listening on the Dark Matter Radio Network, on the next show, which I believe is Jimmy Church. But for our podcast listeners, with 30 seconds left, you have a final thought for them?
Yeah, the evidence is overwhelming. The planet's being visited. We're not being told the truth. And the world of the future is going to be very different from the world of the past.
And with that, I thank you for joining us tonight, Stanton Friedman. Yeah, I consider you the dean of modern ufology. And thank you out there listening for joining us on Podcast UFO. Here comes the music. Until next time, when we're scheduled, well, we'll have another interesting show. Be sure to visit us on our Facebook page or at podcastufo.com.